Hey, folks, we've got a great twill coming up next with lots on privacy and your civil liberties. We've got from the EFF, Julie Samuels, and from Abine, Sarah Downey. Evan Brown is here, too. We'll talk mega upload and tons of privacy stories next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 183, recorded October 12, 2012. Databases of Ruin. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a free 30-day trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter Twill. Hey everyone, Denise Howell here, and you've joined us for This Week in Law. We are all about privacy and civil liberties today, and we've got a great panel today to go through the latest and greatest developments in those areas. Joining us from Abine, their chief privacy strategist, is Sarah Downey. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. It's wonderful to see you and have you on the show.
Thank you.
Now, I knew Sarah was going to be a great person to talk about privacy when we were not otherwise connected, hadn't spoken before. Evan, you suggested that we get her on the show, so I went about trying to get in touch with her. She has a Twitter page, so I could find her there. But when I started combing the web for her email, as I am wont to do when I am tracking down new guests, there was nothing. Total stealth mode on the email. So congratulations to you on that, Sarah.
It means I'm doing a good job.
You are. Excellent. Now, our audience, no doubt, is going to try and go out and find every last possible email address known for you. We'll see how they do.
God, please don't do that.
Yeah, they're the kind of folks who might do that. In the meantime, let's welcome, maybe Julie can help you out if that happens. Julie Samuels from EFF. Hello, Julie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Julie is a staff attorney at the EFF, specializing in intellectual property. And you were hanging out in Evan Brown's neck of the woods for a little while, correct? Are you still on?
I sure was.
Are you still in Chicago?
No, I'm in San Francisco now.
Okay.
But I was out there visiting, and I'm from there too, so I spend a lot of time.
Got it. Well, also joining us from that part of the country is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise, how's it going? You know, I have really been looking forward to this conversation. I'm in some great company today, so this ought to be a lot of fun.
Yes, I agree. Let's start right off and look at some privacy issues. All right, I was bopping along to the privacy music there.
There we go.
Yes, it's very, very soothing. Not so soothing is the advertising industry's response to Microsoft's plan to have Do Not Track on by default in IE10. Looks like Microsoft has taken quite a bit of flack about this, not just from the advertising industry, but also from the W3C, WC3, the World Wide Web Consortium, let's just call them that. They haven't been too pleased with the fact that Microsoft went ahead and pulled the trigger on Do Not Track before a standard had actually been agreed to. But regardless of your feelings on that, there is certainly consumer demand for not being tracked online, and Microsoft responded to that. But it looks as though it's not going to be very much of a powerful tool, because the advertising industry has come right on out and said, you know what, we don't have to respect Do Not Track in IE10, and we're just not gonna. Sarah, what do you think about this?
Oh man, I have a lot to say about this one. I think the advertising industry is being a little bit hypocritical here, because they've been tracking all of us online without our knowledge or permission for a long time. You know, the default was in their court for the longest time. And when Microsoft attempts to come along and actually give a choice to consumers, the advertising industry doesn't want to respect that. And I think that it's really important that people understand what the Do Not Track header really is. It's really just a message that you can broadcast from your browser. All the major browsers have it now, but Microsoft is enabling it by default. But it's really just the equivalent of like you going out in the street and saying, hey, everyone, don't track me, please. And, you know, they don't have to do anything when they get it. And they might actually kind of look at you like you're a crazy person. And in fact, most websites and advertisers do absolutely nothing when they get that message. So the net result of the advertising industry ignoring this in IE really doesn't make that much of a difference. We would like to see them cooperate, but the net reality is Do Not Track alone doesn't do anything for your privacy. And I say that as the manufacturer of a tool that does do something for your privacy. So that's kind of where my standpoint is.
Okay. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, certainly consumers would, even if they even know that Do Not Track is in IE10, and that's one of the big knocks that the advertising folks have put on it in making the stand that they have, is that this isn't really a consumer choice. This is Microsoft's choice. And so yet more reason not to honor it. But certainly the consumer perception, to the extent that people know that it's there, is that this is a good thing. You know, I want to convey this message. And so, you know, at least it's a step in the right direction. You disagree that it has any impact at all?
Well, I think that it's good that the major browsers are paying attention to privacy and recognizing that it's important to people. You know, if they're going to build something like this in, it shows that they're thinking about privacy and that they're trying to do something. And, you know, the standard itself could be really efficient. It could really work if advertisers and websites agreed to do anything about it. The standard is really simple. It's 0, 1, or 2. It's just a header that you're broadcasting. You're saying either, please don't track me, I'm okay being tracked, or I haven't weighed in at all. So what Microsoft is doing is just switching that towards don't track me for everybody. So if advertisers and websites were actually doing something when they received this, it would be great. You know, it'd be awesome. That's what we want, and that's what we're pushing for. But the reality is that it's sort of like we're worried that it gives people a false sense of security, because they hear Do Not Track and they think, great, you know, I click this box, I'm not being tracked, I'm private. And it's not the case at all. We just don't want people to think that that's, you know, they're totally protected, because they're not.
Julie, I know your specialty is more intellectual property than privacy, and we're on a privacy topic here, but I think there is some crossover, because it's difficult to think about people's data being collected and used for profit without thinking about some kind of property interest involved, some kind of protectable property interest, perhaps. And I'm wondering, from your perspective as an IP lawyer, what your feelings are about Do Not Track and the advertising industry's decision not to honor the signals being broadcast by IE10.
I think it's a good question. I think it's an interesting issue. You know, luckily, that's not really impacted, or I should say intellectual property law hasn't really impacted the advances we have seen with Do Not Track so much. And I'm glad to see that that is the case. But as far as owning one's data goes, that's definitely more. Well, we do see companies all the time try and assert ownership in funny and in interesting ways. But luckily, mm-hmm. they haven't tried to use copyright or patent to do that yet.
Well, what about individuals? What about individuals using it?
Individuals claiming that they own an intellectual property right over their own data?
Yeah.
It's an interesting, I guess to some extent you could claim a copyright if, I don't think it's creative though. There's no copyright in that. You wouldn't be able to make that claim.
What do you
think,
Evan?
It's not expressive.
We've gone back and forth about the copyrightability of tweets, and you know, the breadcrumbs you leave behind are even less of a creative endeavor than something you could express in 140 characters or less. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that it's not really the right direction to be taking the discussion and thinking of the aggregate information about what we do as being subject to copyright. I don't think that's going to be too helpful for us in evaluating this at a cognitive level, trying to understand the issues. Because like Julie said, copyright is, I mean, the Supreme Court, has said in 1991 that, you know, originality is that, well, they used the Latin, it's the sine qua non, you know, that which without which copyright protection doesn't exist, you know, the originality. So just this information, this data that is collected by your browsing history and the other things that you do on the internet, the places you go, the people you interact with and all that stuff, those are just facts that certainly are not under any set of circumstances going to arise to protection under copyright law. I think what the real issue here is actually probably more abstract. I'm really glad, Denise, that you asked the question in couching it in terms of an individual's ownership of their information, because it really presents a fundamental question as to what our relationship is with the information that is collected about us. It's certainly not collected by the individual. All this collection is done by, you know, the third party or third parties out there, and the risk comes from the use of that information in for marketing purposes, advertising purposes, and then we don't have to think too far to imagine more nefarious purposes for which it's used. But that doesn't, the fact that the information is collected by a third party or one or more third parties out there doesn't change this fundamental inquiry that I think is important to be made, is what is the individual's interest? And there's plenty of ways that we could articulate it being so important to the individual that it should be treated, if not as a property right, certainly akin to one, and therefore worthy of being protected and recognized as a protectable interest on the level of the individual, no doubt.
Sarah, you tweeted out a scholarly article that I thought was pretty interesting by Chris Hufnagel and Jennifer Urban, both from UC Berkeley, in the law school and the Center for Law and Tech there, and Sue Lee as well. They basically surveyed and got some feedback from, you know, Jane and Joe Public about what they knew about Do Not Track and what they wanted done with their data. And not surprisingly, I mean, I sort of anecdotally was getting the same response from my not too techie friends, you know, parents of other kids in the neighborhood, that kind of thing, that people are really concerned about this. And yet we seem to be at this impasse where not too much effective is being done. There's an investigation that was just opened by Senator Markey. Do you think that that's going to help things at all?
Yeah, well, Markey, he sent out an inquiry to these data broker companies like Axiom, Experian, and so forth. I think it was a couple months ago, asking them, like, what are you collecting about people? What are you doing with it? How can people see it? Just like trying to shine some light on this industry that not a lot of people know a lot about. And Senator Rockefeller just did the same, I believe, like 2 days ago. There's a real need for people to see and understand what these companies are doing with their information. And, you know, there's sort of a distinction between the online tracking that's going on, the data collection that happens at the site level when you're browsing. So when we talk about Do Not Track, that's what we're talking about. And then these big data brokers who are collecting sometimes online information like social network stuff, but largely offline data. So things like supermarket rewards cards, marriage licenses, birth certificates, warranties, and all this stuff is being kind of balled up and being used to build a very detailed profile about consumers. So offline and online, getting a really good picture of who you are, what you like, and using that not only for marketing, but like Evan mentioned, more nefarious purposes. You know, real harms that we've seen include things like identity theft, lowered credit limits, credit scores, not getting a job, stalking. So yes, you said it right when you said people are concerned. And that study, you know, that Hufnagel study shows that people expect do not track to not track them. They expect that it means that it'll stop data collection, because the real important thing here is not about targeted advertising. That's just the tip of the iceberg. It's really about this huge amount of data collection going on to power these ads. And people want to know what's going on and how can they stop it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree that folks are concerned about this, but it doesn't seem to be rising to the level of, say, an election year kind of issue. I didn't watch the vice presidential debates last night. I did watch the first Obama-Romney debates, and I'm not seeing anything. Really, technology issues in general aren't really hitting the radar in the political hot-button discussions. Evan, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I did watch the debates last night, and there were plenty of issues that did not get raised that should have, that, you know, generally are on the radar screen in a political season. You know, like the debates last night didn't talk about immigration, didn't talk about gay marriage, you know, a lot of other issues that are, you know, more oft cited in this. I guess the way that technology and innovation really does come into the equation here is in as much as it would have to do with the overall health of the economy. And I could see some arguments being made, not necessarily saying that these would be the right or the most valid arguments to be made, but in terms of innovation and intellectual property maximalists could try to tie, make a connection between data of that shows that intellectual property protection fosters job growth, and that to the extent there's piracy and all that stuff, piracy causes jobs to be lost. You know, that would be the conclusion to be drawn there. That doesn't change the fact that these issues like privacy are extremely important to us, and you know, really do rise to a pretty high level and should be treated more importantly. It's just that, you know, in the limited amount of time there is to discuss these things in a presidential debate or a vice presidential debate, I guess they just get squeezed out. But, you know, if we had more time to talk about these things in that larger forum, the issues would get played out. I guess it's good that we're sitting talking about evaluating these issues here now, because truly they can have a very real effect on people. And as technology advances and data collection and data mining technologies increase, there's the greater potential for harm, which would go in proportion with that. Sarah was talking about, you know, picking up on something that I had said about, you know, nefarious uses of information collected, like for identity theft. I love the way that Professor Ohm, he was at the University of Colorado, and I think he's with the Federal Trade Commission now, talks about, characterizes them as databases of ruin. You know, being collected about an individual, and you know, you could have just in one data set something that could really make a person's life not good, and that is definitely an issue that is rises to the level of something that should be discussed in the political context as well as just context like this. What we're kicking around ideas here,
right, Julie? Do you see any solution to this sort of disconnect between what people want done with their data and what is actually being done with their data? Is there, you know, any hope on the horizon, any legislation or investigations that EFF is following that you know of?
Well, I mean, I would say we see a lot of disconnect, to get back to the political question a little bit, mm-hmm. between what people want to be doing with their technology and what we see folks in D.C. oftentimes trying to do with their technology, whether it be intellectual property rights or, you know, data concerns and privacy concerns. And that's something that I think the tide is actually starting to turn on. So I was disappointed that technology was brought up in either of these debates. And I think The reason I was disappointed is that after everything that went down with, earlier this year with SOPA and PIPA, we really have seen the tide turn a little bit. We've seen people paying attention. We've seen a lot of users care more, try and play a more active role in the technology that they use, that they rely on, and try and get a better understanding of how that the policies that affect that technology also affect their lives. So, you know, there are two more debates. I'm hopeful that, that it'll be brought up, though not overly optimistic. These technology questions tend to put the high-level candidates, presidential candidates in particular, in a funny particular political spot.
And it's so anachronistic that it isn't at that level, because if you think about it, you know, there are so many different ways that the issue could be introduced into the conversation, whether it be patent reform, you know, copyright and creativity and innovation, privacy, civil liberties. I imagine that at some point in, we'll be talking about, you know, the NSA spying, you know, all of these things that involve technology. To the extent that technology is pervasive in our lives, and that's such an understatement, and it's actually a cliche to talk about that, you know, it has ways of affecting things that we deal with every day. So it is. It seems really unfortunate that the conversation appears to be lagging, and we talk about these other things like, well, not unimportant issues, good grief, but you know, like the economy, and you know, I mean, there was a lot of talk about Afghanistan still in the debate last night. I mean, that still is a very important issue to talk about, but that does not change the fact that technology affects us almost every second of the day.
I'd say just
go ahead, Julie.
I would just say that we've seen, maybe not at the presidential and vice presidential level, but in the House and the Senate, we've seen a lot of movement on these tech issues, both good and bad. So I think we're getting there. It's just a slow process.
I just wanted to give a plug to your colleagues at EFF and especially our friend Trevor Tim, who's been on the show. He has a post up about 14 questions for the presidential candidates to answer at the various debates. And points out that Google is offering users a chance to submit questions ahead of the October 16th debate. And there's a link over in Trevor's post on how you can go over to Google and submit a question. And then Trevor runs down a bunch of questions for both Obama and Romney that touch on these issues, privacy and open internet issues. So, definitely, if you want to push that discussion along, Trevor Tim has a great post on how we individuals might be able to do that. We're here with Sarah Downey from Abine and Julie Samuels from EFF, Evan Brown from Henshaw and Culbertson in Chicago, talking about privacy issues and going to get into a lot more other discussion as well. One privacy issue in particular is when children's privacy is involved, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. First, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. You know that technology has changed the way we all work, but in order to make the most of it, of course, we need the right tools. ShareFile by Citrix is definitely one of those tools. That's why I use it. Industry professionals in law, accounting, financial services, healthcare, marketing, and more all use it. In fact, they rely on ShareFile every day to collaborate with clients and coworkers while maintaining the highest level of security and accountability. So when you're using this product, you can easily send and receive files of almost any size. Instead of attachments, they're sent as secure links on the web. So there are no bounce backs. You're never going to exceed someone's inbox space. You're never going to have to wonder if it got there, because what they're going to get is a link that is active for exactly as long as you need it to be and accessible only to whom you put under the access controls. So you have control over who sees it. There's password protection for optimal security if you need it. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access those files anywhere. You know, it's all in the cloud. So if you're on your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone, you're set to go. It's a great way to make sure that when you're working on sensitive client documents, you have access to them anywhere. And so do they. So it's perfect from sending everything from legal files to confidential contracts. It's really, really wonderful for those things that would otherwise you would have to send a human being to deliver it because it's so big, or you'd wonder whether it ever got through because of email inbox limitations. Whether you're working on terms of service that require a whole lot of back and forth to make sure that everyone understands what's in there and whether it all makes sense, whether you're working on big media files, ShareFile is the perfect solution for collaborating with your clients. So I want you to try ShareFile today with my special offer. Sign up today and receive 30 days absolutely free. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. So let's talk about COPPA. The FTC has been working on bringing it up to date a bit, but the Center for Democracy and Technology is not necessarily happy with the current proposals on the table. CDT is concerned that by putting obligations on developers to know things like whether a plugin has been installed on a children's site, that this is just too much to ask them to police or know. And folks are worried, for example, about how Facebook's like button will fare in a world where you're not allowed to collect data from those under 13, and Facebook is perhaps working on opening up their service to that demographic. So, Sarah, are you paying attention to COPPA, and what do you think of the current proposed changes?
Yeah, I think that it's necessary. You know, it's you can't just have rampant collection of children's personal information, especially with the harms that we've seen come from that kind of data collection. And particularly the like button is interesting to us because we make a add-on called Do Not Track Plus that actually blocks the social buttons from tracking you across the web. Because, you know, the background for those people who don't know is that these buttons are not just for sharing. They also collect, you know, your site activity, visits, and other information to send back to the social network. So these have a presence all across the web, as you've seen. And Facebook is arguing that they have a First Amendment interest. Well, people have a First Amendment interest in using these buttons to express whether they like something, and that therefore they should be able to put these buttons out without any sort of COPPA concerns. So it's an interesting question to follow, you know, but the collection and use of children's personal data has been a big problem, and it continues to be a big problem. So I would like to see some stronger protections in place.
This is one of those arenas where there's a tension between, of course, the desire to protect children online and, of course, the desire for open access, freedom of speech, etc. There's a good article over at Ars Technica about the proposed changes to COPPA that points out that it's the only Protect the Children from the Internet law that hasn't been challenged in court. The Communications Decency Act, the Child Pornography Prevention Act, and the Child Online Protection Act, COPPA as opposed to COPPA, each went to the Supreme Court and were all struck down due to First Amendment concerns about restricting access to information online. Julie, what does EFF think about the new proposals? Obviously, having access to information for adults and older minors is an important consideration.
Sure, and EFF always is paying particular attention to make sure that these laws aren't overbroad and don't impinge on very important fundamental free speech rights. So we're working on watching this closely. And, you know, we'll be careful to do whatever we can to make sure that the FTC and Congress don't go too far.
Sounds good. Evan, what do you think as a dad about all this?
Well, as a dad, obviously my interests are in seeing that information that is gathered about my children using the web is reasonably restricted. You know, purely from a personal standpoint, I would be very much on the privacy side of that. There's no countervailing reason to think otherwise as a parent. As legal counsel to web-based businesses who gather information about their users as an ordinary part of the functioning, I'm a bit more frustrated with COPPA. It's very expensive, essentially impossible to comply with and to know for sure that you're doing everything correct in obtaining parental consent. There are plenty of opportunities for your efforts to comply to go wrong. And the consequences of not doing it right are pretty extreme, have the potential at least to be pretty extreme, because you'll be labeled as someone who brazenly disregards the sensibilities and privacy interests of children. And that's quite an albatross, a marketing albatross to have to bear. So between those two sensibilities, the one that I have as a parent who recognizes a priori the importance of protecting children's privacy, and as legal counsel to businesses who are taxed with complying with this, there's got to be some kind of resolution that strikes that balance well, but more importantly, in the modern context, looks at the ways that information really is protected. I know that there have been some discussions in the past, particularly at the state level. I know California, for example, was looking to revise its state statute that governs what has to be in a website privacy policy to better account for data collection practices on mobile platforms. There's a number of different ways that COPPA has to be brought up to date because of the technology that is there. But moreover, it can. I think that there could be ways to lessen the burden on businesses that want to do the right thing, yet still have a an audience that includes kids that are 13 or under 13 and still not, run the risk of having a disastrous result of noncompliance thrust upon them.
Sarah, I noticed on your Twitter profile that you're both a privacy advocate and a gamer, which I think is a cool dichotomy there, because, of course, the gaming companies collect a whole lot of information about anyone who uses their services, and particularly of concern in our discussion here, little kids. Do you think that they should get any special scrutiny, or that the same rules should apply to everyone?
Well, I think that when we talk about gaming and this sort of tracking that's going on, companies like Zynga and online games are, like in-browser games, are particularly worrisome area because of the amount of tracking that can go on in the browser, and which is the majority of the place where most of us spend most of our time. So when I say gaming, I'm talking about like consoles. I used to have an Xbox 360, but now I have a PS3. But if I were hardcore, I would have a PC. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these gamification systems and games online and reward systems are sort of, they're basically marketing companies in disguise, and they're powered by and fueled by personal information, and they have that appeal to kids. So there has to be special attention paid to them.
Right. It puts parents in this terrible situation that I'm sure you've heard about a lot, where, you need... you need, because you've got a screaming, insistent child demanding to provide access to something that perhaps by law a site is saying that they have to have a certain age limit, or they're protecting their own liability situation. And so parents get in this terrible rock and a hard place situation where they either, say, sorry, you're just going to have to be patient and wait. It's not okay to do this. Or they lie for their kids and set up a profile that, gives them access to what they otherwise wouldn't have. Do you see any immediate solution to that in the proposed changes to COPPA?
Not really. I think it's always going to be a problem. There's whenever you have an age limit for a service, you have kids who are going to sign up anyway. I think Facebook is the perfect example of this. I forget the number, but there are millions of users under 13 on Facebook, and many of them are there because their parents signed them up. So the question isn't really should kids be on Facebook. It's kids are on Facebook and kids are getting tracked across the web in various ways. Their personal information is being used in various ways. And what should be done about it in a way that doesn't completely stifle innovation? I don't know. Good luck with that, Congress.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a conundrum we're not going to solve on this show. Julie, in the news this week was a decision from the United States Supreme Court in a case the EFF has been involved in, also with privacy ramifications, because it involved whether telecom companies should be immune for forking over information in response to requests that maybe should not have been made in the first place. Can you bring us up to speed there?
You know, I actually, these aren't my issues. I'm pretty much an IP lawyer, so I'm probably not the best person here to talk about that.
All right. Well, just to sort of close the loop on this and let people know what happened, we had a Supreme Court case that came down this week that basically confirmed that telecommunication companies are going to enjoy sort of a third-party immunity situation. It actually reminds me, Julie, of what we see on the IP side, the safe harbors in the DMCA, because they're simply the processors of data and they can't be responsible for every single thing that is going on their network, that they're going to be provided with this immunity so that they can continue operations without, you know, grinding to a halt. That's one way of looking at it. Evan, is there a distinction here that you would draw between this and the DMCA?
Well, there's definitely a more sinister perspective to take on it. You know, there was the piece in the show notes for today from The Guardian by Glenn Greenwald. And, you know, Glenn Greenwald seems to not like America. I'll just go ahead and say it. He's pretty cynical about the whole thing, talking about how this is being so overly solicitous to the telecom industry. You know, certainly jumping on the argument that this is an unconstitutional, that the 2008 legislation that retroactively immunized the telecommunications providers for allowing the NSA to come in and, you know, occupy a special room allegedly at the, you know, at the AT&T offices in San Francisco, that was unconstitutional. And so, I mean, if you're to go down that perspective and think of it in this way, you know, this is that it could be pretty bad if there are blatant and obvious and it would be money driven, really. I mean, if you have lobbyists who are affecting legislation in a way, you know, there was some talk, I guess, that it was the same senator who's actually doing the same senator Rockefeller who is doing the investigation now into information collection practices by these huge data brokers, mm-hmm. you know, was one of the prime movers of the legislation that retroactively protected the telecom industry. The whole point of that is to suggest that money and lobbying and influence can change the law in a way that appears to be beyond reproach, even if it served to protect and cover up blatant violations of our civil liberties and our privacy interests. That is a pretty sinister outlook and something that should be pretty scary. But at the same time, the countervailing view to that is what you're talking about, Denise. You know, protecting the telecom companies from the burden and the irritation, the agitation and expense of having to worry about its liability in compliance with what the government is asking it to do. So by no means a simple issue. And the fact that it was in litigation for 6 years testifies to that fact pretty clearly, I think.
Go ahead, Julie.
Can I just jump in for a second? I mean, part of what's so important about the DMCA and when we, you know, in the late 90s, when we really started wrangling with these issues, it was that the internet was a growing technology and people didn't really know where we were going to go. Obviously, telecom is somewhat settled. You know, their technology is in place. So I think that there are a lot of differences there, and it's really important to protect the growing technologies like, you know, in the late 90s, the internet, and still today, too.
Okay. Sarah, your a telecom company and the NSA comes knocking at your door and wants to set up shop and start monitoring traffic, you're kind of, you know, what's a telecom company to do? There's really not too much.
There are a few things that they can. You know, the problem is that the companies store a ton of data because they err on the side of collecting as much consumer data as they can because they might be able to sell it later. They might be able to use it for marketing, whatever. So what they can do is just not have that data to begin with. Like, they basically lose when law enforcement comes knocking and wants that. If these companies have it, they have to turn it over. So one interesting business model is that you might charge a little bit more up front for your service, but that covers privacy. You know, it covers the fact that you're going to store only the minimum amount of personal data that you have to, so that when the law enforcement officials come asking for it, you don't have anything to give them. And I think Cricket Wireless, I believe, is one cell phone company that does this. So they just don't keep that much data. You know, they don't have records of your texts and things like that to turn over.
That's a great approach. I guess Twitter would be another example of at least taking a stand on these issues when the NSA or somebody else comes in, or making it public when they've had to comply with those kinds of requests. Evan, do you think the privacy business model has legs?
I do. It certainly has legs for providers we're talking about here, to the extent that they want to protect the privacy interests of their users, but it also translates into real advantages from a business standpoint as well. Something that is so similar that maybe it's an analogy, maybe it's the same thing, I don't know. I'd have to sit here and think about it for a while, but just in terms of businesses in their information management practices, I guess this is an analogy, because the missing element is the privacy part of it. Oh, and we're talking about privacy. So maybe I'm just eviscerating the whole thing. Who knows? Bear with me while I'm thinking out loud, if you will.
Sure.
You know, businesses and their information lifecycle management, you know, they can enjoy a great advantage in litigation and disputes later on if they're involved in some kind of kerfuffle with an adversary in litigation, because it makes the whole electronic discovery process easier to just say, you know, I ain't got that information anymore. It was deleted. It was done away with pursuant to my information lifecycle management policy. And so I guess, you know, where the analogy maps over is that there is safety to certain interests, whether that be a privacy interest, whether that be some other kind of interest that would be harmed by the disclosure of information, which is, you know, kind of what the nature of privacy protection is all about. There is safety in the appropriate disposal and, you know, getting information that is extraneous out of the way when it can properly be gotten out of the way, so that there's less of a risk of harm based on its disclosure or turning over to somebody who the owner of that information doesn't want to have that information in the first place.
Right. Of course, there can be a convenience trade-off when you are building your business model on making certain data go away. It doesn't necessarily work that great with email, because people's email becomes this valuable resource for them to go back and data mine themselves. I know for me, it becomes my personal journal, memory, you name it. But under a new decision under the Stored Communications Act, and we'll go ahead and make Stored Communications Act our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. New decision out of the state of South Carolina, I believe. The Stored Communications Act is not going to prevent someone from accessing an online email account in a nefarious way. Evan, you always pay attention to these cases. Have you looked at this one?
I looked at it today. I mean, I just first heard about it in preparing for the show today, and it underscores a real problem with the legal framework that we have here for protecting the privacy of information, electronically stored information, and that is exacerbated by the fact that more and more information is being stored not locally. I'm greatly resisting the urge or the temptation to say in the cloud, because I just, you know, that cliche is so irritating. But, right. you know, our information, like you were just talking about in making the segue into this, your email, you know, your Gmail account or your webmail account of choice, all that, those thousands and thousands of messages are stored somewhere other than your hard drive. And that's the primary place we go to look at these things. And the language from the Stored Communications Act that was implicated in this decision from the South Carolina Supreme Court, it pertains to what is the definition of being in electronic storage. And you know, it's the language of the Wiretap Act and the Stored Communications Act is so Byzantine, I don't really want to get into it. But what the court, held in this situation after parsing, examining the language of the Stored Communications Act here is that because it the information in a, I guess it was a Gmail account or a Yahoo account, some web-based account, it wasn't being stored while it was waiting to be transmitted. This was information that had already been read and looked at. And it also, more importantly for this decision, wasn't a backup of the email account. There was no other copy of it anywhere else. This was just the email. And we all know that we store our email in our accounts now.
Archived email.
Yeah, it's called archived. But yes. that's not what it, you know, the at least the South Carolina Supreme Court, and I can't really point to a great way to say how they necessarily got this decision wrong. I think they were constrained by the language of the statute here. You know, it's not an archive. It's not a backup copy when it's, you know, on your Gmail account. And so therefore, it doesn't rise to the level of being in electronic storage and therefore not protected by the Stored Communications Act. If it's not protected, there was no violation when it was accessed in this acrimonious divorce proceeding. It's, you know, as an aside, all these cases so many of these cases seem to come up in domestic relations. There's no shortage of great
Either bad romantic relationships or bad employment relationships seem to give rise to so much law in this area.
They can be equally acrimonious.
Right. Here, a woman who thought her husband was cheating had her daughter-in-law guess his security questions on his account so she could gain access. And then she got a hold of the incriminating emails and they used them in the divorce proceedings. Sarah, have you looked at this case? Clearly, the Stored Communications Act never contemplated all the email we'd be giving to Google, for example.
Yeah. You know, a lot of these privacy laws are very, very out of date. So when I think of electronic communications, I think of email, and I think that should be protected. And I think most reasonable people's expectation is that it's protected. But I think you summed it up perfectly when you're saying there's always a trade-off between convenience and privacy. You know, we're at Abine, we're trying to make it not the case. We're trying to make tools that give you privacy really easily without you having to think hard. But in this case with email, it's great to be able to go and search through all your archives and find things that you didn't have accessible previously. But because they're stored, they're going to be accessible to law enforcement too. And can come up in cases like, you know, it's not always divorce and hiring. You know, I've seen a lot of child custody as well. So using your emails that you thought wouldn't see the light of day in court to show whether you're a fit parent.
Right. Evan, I guess it bears pointing out that the Stored Communications Act is what was sued under here, but there was probably a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim that could have been brought as well because of the way in which they accessed the account, don't you think?
Could have been. I don't know anything about the facts of this case other than what's in this story. It was an Ars Technica piece by Cyrus Farivar that came out yesterday about this. So, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is equally Byzantine, you know, compared to the Stored Communications Act. And you know, the kind of the similarity is there's this notion of unauthorized access or access without, you know, exceeding authorization. There's, you know, great similarities across the two statutes there. But one thing that makes the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act sometimes a stumbling block that claims under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act often encounter is this idea of damage to the computer. And many courts hold that for there to be a claim under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the loss has to arise from some damage to the computer. And the damage has to be like, you know, deletion of data or the kind of harm that's suffered when there's a DDoS, a denial of service attack or something like that, where the computer is actually harmed, not the fact that your feelings are hurt or that you lose custody of your kids or some other kind of damage like that. That's not contemplated under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So again, after, you know, going through that whole exposition, I have to go back and say, I don't know what the facts were in this case, but I'm skeptical that there would be the kind of damage that some courts require to sustain a claim under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act under these set of facts.
Okay, well, what we're left with then is some conflicting decisions out there and perhaps the need for the Supreme Court to take a look at exactly what happens when someone accesses your cloud-based email without your permission, because there's a case out of the Ninth Circuit that says that's not okay. So now we have a conflict. Let us look
I know you want to move on, but I guess I'll Joe Biden the issue. There wouldn't be a split here if this was the South Carolina Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit. I don't think the Supreme Court would care about that when granting a petition for cert, would it? Since it's not a circuit split, you know, it's a state court and a federal court.
I think that can be the kind of thing that they'll look at. Yeah, that, you know, the highest court in a state definitely has high precedential value. And if it's not in line with another influential court's position, I think it's the kind of thing that they can take up. You know, they can do what they want, Evan.
I guess you're right. I will defer to your appellate expertise on that. Sounds good enough, what you're saying.
They can decide. Well, I don't know. I just think that the Supreme Court has a broad discretion in what they decide to take on cert, and there's so little that they actually do that it doesn't much matter. Let us move on and take a look at a development from the world of the social web.
You know, all the music is pretty soothing, isn't it? You know, you can just kind of be.
There we go. Thank you, Franklin Graves. As though our show were not, you know, somnambulistic enough. Franklin, when he made our bumpers, is trying to lull us all even further into a state of technological legal wonkhood. Let's take a look at the Facebook-sponsored story settlement. We talked about this before and how a judge didn't think that Facebook had been required under the terms of its settlement regarding the sponsored stories that people didn't know their profiles were going to be associated with, that the payment was going to be too low in the judge's mind. Well, now they've come back and the new settlement proposed might give users as much as $10 a piece if they were impacted by Facebook's actions in question here. But we're not quite sure how that's all going to shake out. It could be as little as $5. It could be nothing at all. So as with most class action settlements, the payout to the class is probably not going to be substantial. But it is, you know, notable that Facebook at least, you know, is responding to complaints about what its conduct was here. I don't know that I would necessarily consider this a privacy issue as much as a terms of service issue, because of course people probably agreed to have Facebook use their data in this way. That, you know, I don't know how far Facebook would push that. They're obviously settling this case. Sarah, what do you think about the privacy ramifications of sponsored stories and this proposed settlement?
There was actually some question in the complaint about whether people actually did agree to this, because there was a large class of the plaintiffs who had signed up at a time when Facebook's terms didn't actually say anything about their images being used in sponsored stories. So they actually didn't agree to it. Mm-hmm. But there is a privacy part to this, and it's privacy and right to publicity, because, you know, when you think normally about right to publicity, you think about a famous person having their image used to get large amounts of money. And here you had not famous people whose images were being used to make much smaller amounts of money. But in mass, it all added up to a whole lot, you know, because it is valuable if someone in your friend network likes something or tweets about something. I mean, not tweets, we're on Facebook, but posts about something. That endorsement does have value. And for you to be making those endorsements and Facebook to be profiting off of them without your ability to collect anything, it seems like it would be a violation. And for you to say that you like something and then have it be taken out of context and used in advertising is also a privacy issue. You know, a lot of privacy is the ability to control when and how and where and in what context your information shows up. And if I'm clicking that I like a page, and I don't expect that it's going to be like, hey, Sarah liked this page and let's show everybody on Facebook that, I might be a little bit uncomfortable with the privacy implications there.
Right. I guess, you know, another little privacy twist to this is people are circumspect about whether or not Facebook has an address for them, be it their home address or some other way of contacting them in the real world. If you don't have a Facebook address, I don't know how you would get paid from the settlement at this point. Maybe they could email you that a check is available if you respond. What do you think, Evan?
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought it that far through, but you know, I certainly would not want Facebook to have my home address to the extent that it hasn't figured it out already, and I'm not even on Facebook. So, you know, it seems, you know, stepping back on this, that Facebook is walking a fine line here, and this is an interesting mix of right of publicity issues and privacy issues, and you know, the right of publicity idea kind of has a common genesis with, you know, privacy. And, you know, it's easy to kind of conflate and think of privacy and publicity in two different ways that are the same here. But it seems like from a business level, Facebook is walking a pretty fine line. And this does have privacy implications here, because if it's going to be well known that it's likely that your name and visage will show up in connection with the advertisement for services, it would make the individual user less likely to do that. And what's going to be going on in the mind of the user is, wait, I don't want my information out there. So for the same reasons that they would be concerned about privacy, they would not click the like button in the first place, which in turn is going to harm the potential for advertising revenue. Certainly a lack of information, you know, lesser information is being gathered here. So it, you know, Facebook, I would think, is being pretty careful in how far to push this and how aggressive to be in asserting its rights that it would have to actually appropriate people's identities in this way. So an interesting mix of different sensibilities play into this whole analysis.
Right. Julie, we're right back to user data and whether or not it can be an IP right, I guess, with the right of publicity being a species of intellectual property right.
Sure.
Are you happy about the settlement? Do you think that it's compensating the users for Facebook's conduct here?
Well, the part you brought up that I think is the most interesting is the terms of service piece. And it really does go to illustrate, to the extent that users never even signed a term or were never even presented with a term that covered this, that's obviously a fundamental contract problem. But to the extent that this might have been in the terms for some of these users, it really goes to show how ineffective terms are at all protecting users in cases like this. I mean, who reads those things? So that is something that I find to be kind of fascinating. And I think, you know, the law is not really moving there at all right now. But I think eventually it's going to have to, whether it comes from the Hill or from the courts, something's got to change.
Right. And ironically, somewhat ineffective for Facebook, too, because if some users were covered and some weren't and they're still settling, you know, they're just showing that they don't want to take this to the mat and want it to go away. And gee, sorry, we made a mistake and we'll move on. I didn't have this in our discussion points for the week, but Sarah, you were probably paying attention to the fact that some hacker was willy-nilly extracting phone numbers from Facebook this week in some kind of security flaw. Any further thoughts you want to give us on that?
I had heard of it, but I'm not super familiar with what happened, except I know that it has to do with the fact that Facebook prompts you to give them your cell number, and they say it's for verification and security and whatever. It's really just so that they can get your number. I mean, you can verify with all sorts of other ways, but I think it has to do with the fact that you can search for and find a person on Facebook just by putting in a phone number. Like those things are linked now with the new statement of rights and responsibilities that Facebook put out. Not really new, but a couple of weeks or maybe a month ago, that when you put in somebody's phone number, it's sort of like a caller ID, like a reverse caller ID. You can immediately find out who they are. And with people putting in their phone numbers into their profiles and putting them in through this verification system, this hacker was actually able to extract them. And I don't know like how many he got or how he actually did it, but it's just a reminder of the fact that Facebook has a lot of info on all of us. They're not the most secure platform, and they don't have the greatest track record when it comes to protecting user data.
No, they really don't. It's kind of unfortunate, but true. All right, let's move on and look at some stories in the world of entertainment. All right, so Evan, we love talking about the BitTorrent porn suits here on The Twill, and we've got a good opportunity to do it this week. We have a Pennsylvania judge who thinks that some of these suits may not be as strong as the plaintiffs are saying they are. What happened here?
Well, this is in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. It's one of these mass copyright infringement lawsuits. This one brought by Malibu Media, which is a pretty active plaintiff, owner of adult films. And the judge is taking an interesting procedure here. He's holding what he's calling a bellwether trial. And I hadn't heard that term actually used in the title of an order. But, you know, the judge is saying, you know, I'm going to hold the trial. I'm going to single out five of the defendants here to stand trial in this situation because they have asserted certain arguments that, you know, for example, I didn't trade any files by BitTorrent, or I wasn't home there, or, you know, whatever reason. So what it is truly is, you know, being a bellwether, that, you know, the what that word means is, you know, having the ability to influence others of its kind later, is really to put the plaintiff to the test here and test its mettle to see if it really can come up with the kind of evidence that is needed to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that there was copyright infringement that was happening here. And what the secondary closely related effect of that is to see whether and to what extent the plaintiffs truly are interested in litigating copyright claims here, or whether they just want to take this more extortionate route of extracting quick settlements from people, which certainly has been the pattern of what these copyright plaintiffs do, especially in the context of adult films, where the risk of reputational harm to those defendants who don't settle out quickly before their identity is revealed, that interest is very great in these types of situations, which fosters more extortionate kind of behavior, I would suggest. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes on. It looks like we have a trial date set for sometime in April. And the judge is really discouraging the plaintiff from going through with this trial here. And I suppose the defendants are equally as probably equal parts eager and reluctant to go to trial here. But it could have larger effects on seeing how these kinds of cases play out and play into the efficiency of the plaintiff's business model in filing these extortionate mass suits. So,
right. The poor defendants. I wonder how they got selected to be the test cases or not. Julie, is EFF involved in any of these Malibu Media cases?
We've been involved in a large number of these cases. We file amicus briefs often, and we work. Many of the individuals who find themselves on the receiving end of these cases reach out to us, and we've got a pretty good network of folks. We try and get those people help. I'm really glad to see this judge tee up the merits of the case, because, you know, as Evan said, that's not happened before. And I think it's time to really bring some of these plaintiffs to task and find out what's going on here. My understanding is these particular defendants all filed something, and that's why the judge chose them.
So they have some way to actually come to court and say something about the claims against them, as opposed to just being unrepresented. Yeah, it seems like the EFF's efforts and others' efforts to enlighten the courts about the sort of mass nature of these cases and cast some skepticism on the merits of the claims may have hit a chord here with Judge Bailson. And it's nice to see that that we're going to see some, you know, put your cards on the table kind of approach from the judge in these cases. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's important to point out here that, you know, it may not be all that easy for a defendant to prevail in these situations, because, you know, if there is evidence, you know, because the technology that the plaintiffs use to track IP addresses is pretty sophisticated. I could see there being some interesting arguments involving expert testimony to add some strength to the reliability of the technology that the plaintiffs are using to find IP addresses associated with a particular swarm. But, you know, to the extent that that is, associated with that account, there's going to be prima facie evidence of infringement going on here. So these are not going to be inexpensive cases to litigate at all. In fact, quite the contrary. There'll be expert testimony on, you know, that technology used to track the IP address. There will probably be some pretty heavy duty forensics going on the defendant's hard drives to, you know, unfortunately, even though you're not liable until proven liable in this country, I don't see a way that a defendant will be able to successfully say, hey, I didn't do it and I never did it, unless you can show, you know, look, my hard drive doesn't have any evidence of torrenting on it whatsoever, not even a fragmented, portion of a file here. So there's it's certainly an uphill battle for the defendants in these situations, notwithstanding the tenuous what our belief is of the tenuous evidence that plaintiffs may have in this situation. So it's not going to be an open and shut case for these defendants, even though they're going to trial.
Yeah, absolutely. They'll have a challenge. Julie, any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I guess there's just one more thing I would say. I think Evan's dead on that these are not going to be easy cases to litigate. However, I'd also point out that I think you're going to see a lot of, I don't know, it's not mistaken identity, but the folks who hold the account for the IP address, many of them have, you know, open Wi-Fi, or they have other people living in their house, or they had guests over. So the defendant is the account holder, but likely not the only person that uses that account. So I think that's a really important issue, and I hope the court takes this opportunity to get that right.
Yes, hopefully they will, because there seems to be some confusion out there over what kind of liability can accrue to the account holder if somebody else was the actual downloader. And hopefully all five of these defendants are alive and kicking. That would be nice in one of these cases. Let us make Bellwether Trial our second MCLE passphrase for the show. And that's Bell, B-E-L-L, Weather, W-E-T-H-E-R. And if you're wondering what that is, if you're a lawyer and you're required to get mandatory or otherwise continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction, we have a great grid up on our wiki at wiki.twit.tv that will guide you through seeking MCLE credit for watching or listening to this show in your jurisdiction. So I encourage you to check that out. Speaking of jurisdictions, let's talk about Mega Upload. I guess we're going to be able to go forward against him, Julie. What happened there?
Oh, well, there a couple things happened this week in the Mega Upload case, actually. The thing you're talking about right now is there was a ruling from the judge on these jurisdictional concerns. Mega Upload had filed a motion to dismiss, claiming that the U.S. courts had no jurisdiction, they have no presence in the United States, neither the corporation nor any of the individuals. The judge almost punted a little bit and said, you guys can bring this up again, but if Kim.com or some of these other folks come to the United States, they can be served. So in other words, the judge said, we're going forward, but we'll see what happens. So the underlying case, not much changes. We'll see where they go.
This, This is a huge issue in these kinds of cases, though, right? It's why Pirate Bay is talking about putting servers in the sky. That, you know, they just, the idea is to make it as hard as possible to get jurisdiction over one of these companies and have rights holders bring suit, or hear the government bring suit against them. So it seems like a constant cat and mouse game, and here the court is saying, you know, it doesn't matter where they were located. They violated U.S. law, impacted U.S. citizens, and so we're going to go ahead and make this the venue where they are sued. Am I getting that right?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, what's to try and read between some of the lines a little bit, I think the judge recognizes that it's a big case. It's a big case. And I don't think he wants to throw it out on these procedural grounds, at least not yet. I also think the U.S. court's been moving a little bit slower than we usually see in the Eastern District of Virginia. And I think that's because there's been such a mess in New Zealand surrounding what went on with regard to the searches and the seizures that the judge is hoping that maybe the New Zealand courts will deal with this somehow.
Evan, do you think this was properly decided?
I think so. I mean, from what I understand, it's a... I think it was properly decided, but I don't think that really has much of an impact on the larger question. This seems to be a kind of a little procedural thing that is not going to affect the merits too much. I mean, I would defer to Julie. I mean, you know, Julie, there's nobody on the planet who's, you know, who can speak better on the whole mega upload stuff than what Julie says. But as far as this little thing about this decision here with the, you know, whether they can be indicted, I think that that's something that we'll have to see play out a little bit later. Nothing wrong with this particular decision here.
Okay. Anyone want to talk about Pandora? We spoke a bit last week about the fact that Tim Westergren would like to see us reform the royalties laws. This week, he revealed how much artists are getting paid by having their tracks played on Pandora. The knock against services like Pandora and Spotify, other streaming services, is that the amounts paid to artists are so negligible, it's not really something that can support the music industry standing alone. Well, I don't think anybody's arguing that internet radio is what's going to support the music industry standing alone. And here Tim Westergren is saying, we're actually paying really significant amounts both to obscure artists that you've never heard of, and he's talking about $10,000 each to over 2,000 artists, $50,000 each to over 800 artists, and millions of dollars between 1 and 3 million. But when you get that high, does it really matter, he says. Two artists such as Coldplay, Adele, Wiz Khalifa. You got me on Wiz Khalifa. Jason Aldean, Drake, and Lil Wayne. So they've got some real numbers going out, I guess, is his point. And that, you know, more force behind his argument that internet radio is economically beneficial to the music industry and needs help if it is to survive. Julie, do you think that this is a good thing that Pandora's releasing these numbers?
I think it's a great thing. First of all, I'm in favor of any kind of transparency on these, all these different services, explaining, you know, how they pay artists, what they pay artists, how they work. And I think Tim makes a lot of really good points. And I think, you know, what we're seeing in a lot of the traditional content industry, but particularly in the music industry, is that when we let a million flowers bloom, we're all better off. And it's important that we have policies that, you know, help those flowers bloom, if you will, that incentivize these businesses to grow, that give artists all different types of avenues to make money. What's unfortunate, of course, is that there's a pretty big hangover from a more antiquated business model. And there's lots of people who get their hands on that money that Pandora pays out. Unfortunately, it's not just the artists, of course. It's the labels and everyone else who gets a cut. And, you know,
Sound exchange is such a... Never mind. Go on. Sorry.
And, you know, that's not all. That's not to say that's all bad. I mean, again, there's a large ecosystem surrounding music. And I want to see all the Pandoras and the Spotifys and many of the labels. I want to see all of these organizations do well, and particularly do well by the artists. Because that's right. The promise of the technology, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it keeps, you know, we're talking about mega upload in the prior story. It keeps people off the BitTorrent, anything else that they're using to get music illegally every
it's
time
like the
that
methadone.
There is.
Yeah, you know, it is an interesting point. And there's this piece of the mega upload case that came out, or I should say that was reported on a bunch of, at the outset of that case that we haven't talked much about lately. And it's that there were actually a ton of artists who were using mega upload to connect directly with their fans. And Mega Upload did have, from what I understand, it's really just press reports and anecdotal evidence. It had a lot of legitimate users who were sharing music. And that's a good thing. You know, we want to incentivize these new business models. And of course, there are going to be bumps along the road. And that's okay, too, I hope and I think. But what's been so unfortunate about Mega Upload and some of these other cases that we've seen happening in the past couple of years, particularly when it's the government bringing them, is that it really puts a chilling effect, I fear, on a lot of these new businesses. So I'm glad Tim West, you know, to come full circle to Pandora, I'm glad Tim's out there and I'm glad he's making the case and trying to create an environment that lets companies and businesses like his be profitable both for the business and for the artists.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where he's talking about millions of dollars going to bands like Coldplay. I think, you know, if you're a band like Coldplay and you're making $1 million from Pandora, that's sort of like, okay, gee, thanks. It's sort of like, you know, when my blog on Amazon sends me a couple of dollars because people have subscribed to it on their Kindle. You know, it's a nice thing, but it's a couple of dollars. So it's not necessarily going to support the band, but it's, you know, it's definitely better than having them losing money, as the industry argues, from people getting their music without paying for it in any way. Julie, any thoughts about this? I'm sorry,
yeah.
Sarah.
You're sort of outside my realm here.
Yeah. Julie, you were going to chime in. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, I was going to say probably a little bit more of what I've been saying already. But the other thing Tim wrote in that blog post that I think is really interesting, a really interesting point, is that there's this promise of an age for the middle class musician, and that's kind of what the technology opens up. Musicians who can make a living playing music and maybe not be, you know, Lady Gaga or Coldplay. And I think we've yet to realize that. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think there were so many middle class musicians under the old business model either. But I think we're getting a little bit closer. And what's really great about a lot of these business models is that it lets artists retain control over their careers that for a long time they did not have.
I get it. So it's that 40% of Americans would love those $2, Denise, from Amazon.
Well, no, who wouldn't love $2? You know, it buys you part of a coffee at your local coffee shop. I'm not arguing that $2 is a bad thing. It's just, you know, somewhat negligible.
Yeah, this whole statement by Tim Westergren talking about, you know, that artists are making all this money and as a matter of fact, they should take a pay cut. I mean, that's a wonderful example of how somebody can, and this is really a fine art, only a few people can do this well, simultaneously give a compliment and an insult. And for that reason, I'm with Julie in saying that transparency is good, and it's great that Pandora made this information available because it gives us some context to work in about what the revenue model for all this stuff looks like. But, you know, the fact that you're calling for it to be less, yeah, I see, Tim, where that's actually just the flip side of the argument. You know, it's the other side of the coin on the same argument that this should be an equal playing field with terrestrial radio and other, you know, music outlets. But it just seems like that's not the best way to make the argument. You've got some great facts on your side by showing the disparity between, Section 803 of the Copyright Act and Section 114 of the Copyright Act, you know, the different compulsory licensing models here. Focus on that. Don't say that the artists in some situations need to be paid less, because that's just kind of striking. That's the insult that is delivered simultaneously with the compliment.
All right. Well, a quick update in the Google Books case, a decision from a federal trial judge that has the case against the universities who took place, the HathiTrust Digital Library, that they individually were sued, as opposed to, you know, obviously Google has been in settlement talks for a long, long time about this too. But the plaintiffs decided to go after the universities who participated in the scanning project. That case has been dismissed by a trial judge, saying that the universities were operating under fair use and are protected. So I'm sure that that is a to be continued kind of decision, and that we will probably see appellate proceedings on that. But that's where things stand now. Evan, did you take a look at this, and are you surprised at this outcome?
It has not been my design at all to channel Joe Biden, you know, at all today. But this is a big effing deal. This decision, you know, with the HathiTrust, because this is the since 2005, we've been sitting here only in a theoretical manner, applying the fair use factors, you know, under the Copyright Act, you know, those four factors that you look at under section, was it 107, Julie? Is that right? And, you know, and the fair use factors. And, you know, finally, there is a legal opinion that applies those fair use factors to the factual context, albeit not the one that's like front and center with the Authors Guild suit that was filed in 2005. But, you know, the factual scenario arising from the Google, if you really want to be old school, you could call it Google Print, you know, the Google book search endeavor here that applied it. And it was, you know, a very definitive decision in favor of fair use, you know, that the court applied the fair use factors. You know, the transformative nature of what's going on here was you know, really carried the day almost in and of itself. This, you know, for the scanning being done for the purposes of search. So that's why this is, you know, this is a big deal. Certainly not the end of the story of, you know, for the whole dispute, but definitely quite notable in the fact that we actually have a court saying something about fair use when it comes to the Google book search project.
Yeah, Julie, EFF used to have a slogan that said, and maybe it still does, fair use has a posse. I guess U.S. Yeah. District Judge Harold Bear is now in it.
I think that's right. This was a huge victory. This was great. There's so much good news in here, but just to, I mean, to be clear, I would love to have been in the room with the publishers when they decided this was a good idea to bring this case. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we're talking about here is there's like ability to search and find. It's essentially like a modern day card catalog. It's not as if you can just read the whole book. There are all these stories about folks, you know, with certain disabilities who are now able to get access, people who... It's just the public interest piece is so compelling. And the judge really, he understood that and, you know, commented on just how amazing this is for society. So I think strategically the publishers in bringing this particular case, they had a real uphill battle and that shows. And I think this is going to, I think Evan's right. This was a really big effing deal.
All right. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about it then. Hey, we have some great resources and tips for you this week, so let's move right to them. Sarah, we were talking about how Facebook has lots of information about all of us. And of course, you can tell Facebook things about how they can use your information. But what people don't often know is that oftentimes apps will ask for information that you have access to because you're friends with people, and then it can sort of indirectly get to their information as well, even though they haven't authorized it. You have some advice on how to deal with that situation. Can you give us that as one of our tips of the week?
Sure. You know, it's one of those many privacy settings that's kind of buried in Facebook's privacy settings page. I think I've counted 42 separate settings at this point. But it's a pretty powerful way to stop your friends from sharing your personal information through the apps that they're using. So just to be clear, it's not that you're doing anything directly with these apps. It's that your friends are authorizing apps themselves. Those apps can go through and pull your data. So some of the most common ones that do this are Yahoo, Daily Horoscope. And then there's one that I mentioned in the post called Branch Out, which is a career networking app. And it requests your basic info, if you're the user, but also your and your friends' current locations, your and your friends' work and education history, your email address. So a lot of different things. So to make sure that you're not one of those people who's leaking your friends' personal information on Facebook, first you want to log into Facebook, then go to privacy settings at the top right. Then on the privacy settings page, there's a category for ads, apps, and websites, and you're going to click edit settings next to that. And a little box will open that says how people bring your info into apps that they use. You can click edit settings beside that. And then you're going to have a pop-up box that says how people bring your info into apps they use. And if you want to go the full privacy as much as you can get, you should uncheck all 17 boxes there and then hit save changes. Because otherwise, you know, if you can see those things listed, you're providing things like birthday, hometown, religious and political views, not only for yourself, but for the people that you're friends with on Facebook. So do all of them a privacy favor and take care of these steps.
Yeah, that's absolutely a wonderful tip. I remember recently setting up my mother-in-law's Facebook account and getting confronted with this as I went through and monitored all the privacy settings that needed to be tweaked for her, and being stunned at this particular use of other people's information through your Facebook account. So that's great to get the word out about that. And if you want to refer to the step-by-step process, Sarah has written it up at the Abine blog, so you can find it there at abine.com. Julie, what should a user do? We were talking about legitimate users of Mega Upload, the bands that wanted to get their music out that way. I'm sure there are tons of people who were just using it as a place to put big files. If they've had their legitimate data seized, what can they do?
Well, you know, unfortunately, my tip is not quite so helpful yet, at least. We're representing one of those individuals right now. His name is Kyle Goodwin, and we've been in litigation in the Mega Upload case trying to get his stuff back. It's been tough. The good news is that, as you see on the screen right now, the court is entertaining this, and it's frankly logistically complicated, which, of course, I don't think is any excuse for him not getting his stuff back. But, you know, the government has seized all of Mega Upload's property. The data is on some third-party servers, which are essentially sitting on ICE right now in Virginia. Mega Upload's got no money to pay them to turn it back on. And other parties, too, have gotten involved. The MPAA, for example, filed a brief asking that a lot of these files not get put back into the stream of commerce, as they said. So right now, the parties are fighting to get these individuals their stuff back. But, you know, if anyone out there is someone who has files on Mega Upload that they want returned, one thing they can do in the short term is send an email to megauploadmissing@eff.org, or to me, julie@eff.org. And we'll try and rope other folks in if we see some success with our case. And I hope we will see some success, because there are a lot of legitimate users out there. And they did nothing but put their stuff up on a cloud storage service. And we all put our stuff in cloud storage all the time, of course, right? Google, Amazon, right. Apple. And we so have an expectation that it's still going to be there.
Yeah. Right. So here's another privacy twist to cloud storage. If your cloud storage service winds up getting pulled down because there are allegedly infringing activities going on there, to what extent has Kyle Goodwin had to come in, and to what extent will other users have to come in and say exactly what it is that they put up there that is legitimate stuff that they can't get back now?
I think that's a really good question, and it totally remains to be seen. What we've asked the court to do is to create some kind of procedure, some kind of process that lets these individuals, these people, request their stuff back. Will they probably have to say what they want back? As a practical matter, I think so, and I think you're right. That raises a whole bunch of other concerns, too. And I think, frankly, that this is where the government kind of messed this up from the outset. when the government went in and pulled down the mega upload site, it should have done this while thinking about the third parties whose property rights were being harmed. And it didn't do that. So now we're kind of facing this mess. And the concerns you bring up about privacy are totally legitimate. But we're kind of left with our hands tied in order to get the stuff back. I don't know. We don't know how that best will work yet. But what we've asked the court to do is to entertain this conversation, to allow us to bring in experts, to bring in the people who know how this works, not unlike a receiver maybe in a bankruptcy case, to navigate this.
All right. Well, one final tip this week has to do with iOS 6. I'm not sure which of you dropped this into the spreadsheet, but there's a great article at Business Insider on turning off location tracking for advertising purposes in iOS 6, and it's not very easy to do. Who dropped this in?
I did.
Evan did. Thank you. This is a great tip. Of course, lots of people have been busily upgrading their iOS devices to iOS 6, and what hasn't been so public about it is that there is new tracking technology called IFA or IDFA, which stands for ID for Advertising, that is on by default in iOS 6. I've noticed as I've been upgrading devices, there is a new privacy tab in the OS, but that's not where you would turn this off. You have to go to General, About, then Advertising, then toggle Limit Ad Tracking to On. So it's not exactly intuitive, but it is possible to turn it off. Probably not too many people will do it, but if you are conscious about these things, there's a good piece of Business Insider on how to go about doing it.
It's so funny because, you know, I mean, there's nothing, you know, inherently confusing about that, going to General About Advertising, you know, on your breadcrumb trail on that. But it's right above the privacy.
The privacy tab.
You go to the privacy. So that's what makes it so counterintuitive, I think.
Yes, which is where the rest of their location-based stuff is. So you would think they would put all that together if they really wanted people to be able to meaningfully control that setting. Speaking of meaningful control and tools that put you in charge of what's being done with your data and how you're being tracked, great resource. Evan, I think you pointed to this in your Twitter stream called Privacy Fix. It's for Google Chrome. You want to tell us what this does?
Oh, that I can't claim this one. It wasn't me. But,
oh, it wasn't you. Maybe I saw it then.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, it looks good. I mean, it's. Yeah. I mean, it really is kind of like, you know, Sarah's explanation of the nuances of changing your privacy settings in Facebook underscore how helpful something at the browser level can be to just kind of be more of a blanket setting for your privacy settings on Facebook. So that's what this is. I mean, it's a Chrome extension and also a Firefox plugin as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I saw in all this. So.
Yeah, I haven't installed it yet, but it looks really good and I'm going to give it a try. It's monitoring your Google and Facebook settings. It's like, I know we featured at one point something that would go through and chug through those, you know, dozens of pages of privacy settings on Facebook and tell you how you're doing. It's like that, but it operates in the browser. So it looks like a nice little tool. I'm going to download it and give it a run. And I encourage the rest of you to check it out too. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It's been really fun discussing privacy, IP, and social web-related concerns with you guys today. Julie Samuels from EFF, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks. Real pleasure.
We are so grateful for the work that you do over there at EFF, and say hi to our friends. We have lots of them.
I will.
Good. We'll hope that you come back on the show again. Is there anything in particular? There's always something going on at EFF that's an action item that maybe we should draw attention to before we wrap the show.
Oh my God, there are so many. I wouldn't even know where to begin.
What's your pet project?
Mega Uploads is taking up a ton of time, and something we didn't get to talk about, and I really would like to in the future, is software patent work. We're working hard to reform that, and then ask folks to go look at a site we've got at defendinnovation.org. It's got some proposals, and we're trying to collect data from those in the out there in the world who actually really interact with the patent system. So help us out.
Great. We will do that. And then Sarah over at Abine, also a great service that people need to check out if they are concerned with privacy and controlling their data on the web. Something I've seen mentioned a lot on the VRM list. And so I encourage people to check out abine.com. And Sarah, it's been really fun chatting with you on the show today.
Thank you. You too. It was fun.
And we'll continue to watch your Twitter stream, which is full of good information at Sarah A. Downey on Twitter. And Evan, great chatting with you again, too.
Hey, I think I've had the most fun of anybody. It's been an awesome show. Sarah, Julie, great to talk with you. Sarah, nice to meet you. Julie, good to see you again. I tell you what, that was a great talk that you gave at the Chicago Bar Association a couple of weeks ago. I've heard a lot of people talk about how informative that was when you were there talking about Mega Upload and some of the other government shenanigans going on. So it was nice to meet you in person, and great to talk with you again today on the show.
Thanks. Yeah, this was great, you guys.
All right. So for those of you tuning in live, we thank you for having joined us. If you're listening after the fact, you know you can watch us live when we record. That is every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC. And you can tune right on in with us at twit.tv. We love to have you. If you can't do that, of course, our shows are made available in all kinds of formats. They're on YouTube. They're at our site at twit.tv/twill. The whole archive of shows is there going back to 2006. And oh, in fact, we're coming up real soon on our 6th anniversary of the show toward the end of this month. So we're looking forward to that. In the meantime, you can help us put together the shows that we're doing each week by going to our Google Plus page and our Facebook page, where we love hearing from you and getting input on stories you're following that you'd like us to look at, more information about the stories we discussed that you want to add your gloss to. We love hearing about that. And if you're not a Facebook or a Google Plus person, then email us. Evan is evan@twit.tv. I am denise@twit.tv. Love hearing from you. Love your input on the shows. So with that, we'll go ahead and say goodbye. Until next time, this has been This Week in Law. Take care.